This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, the 1st of June, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.
Now it's going to be up to the Iranians to make their decision. And if they choose not to verifiably suspend, we have laid the groundwork for an effective international response.
The Bush administration makes tough warnings to Iran over that country's move to enrich uranium. And it's the 1st of June. We'll hear from New Orleans on the official start date of the hurricane season. These stories and more after the headlines.
From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, I'm Mitch Jezerich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. As Iran rejects potential talks with the U.S. over its nuclear program, former U.N. weapons inspector Hans Blix said today that the U.S.'s unwillingness to cooperate in international arms agreements was undermining efforts to reduce the threat of nuclear weapons. Blix made the comment in the introduction of a commission report handed to UN General Secretary Kofi Annan today. The report concluded that, quote, an increased U.S. skepticism regarding the effectiveness of international institutions and instruments, coupled with a drive for freedom of action to maintain an absolute global superiority in weaponry, is undermining efforts to curb nuclear proliferation. A deadline set by African Union mediators for the two remaining rebel groups in the Darfur region to sign a peace agreement has expired, Joshua Kailimpa reports.
The African Union Commission Chief Alpha Omar Konare is due to announce the next steps to be taken on the two Sudan rebel groups, the Justice and Equity Movement and the faction of the Sudan Liberation Army, who are refusing to sign a deal agreed to on the 5th May that would end the conflict in the Darfur region of southern Sudan. The AU has warned that the rebels refusing to sign the agreement could face sanctions and that it will urge the UN Security Council to do the same. The two rebel groups said the current deal is unjust and are asking for, among others, more political posts in the proposed transitional government. The rebels took up arms in February 2003, accusing the government of discriminating against Darfur's black Africans in favor of Arabs. The Sudanese army and the pro-government Janjaweed militia then began attacking civilians in Darfur, driving people from their homes and attacking refugee camps. Sudan denies arming the Arab militias and says the problems have been exaggerated. Joshua Chalimpa, FSRN, Kampala.
Oil markets were jittery around the world as the world's oil producers met today at the OPEC conference hosted by Venezuela and President Hugo Chavez. Naomi Fowler reports.
Geopolitics are as center stage as ever when it comes to oil prices, which initially fell at news that the US was prepared to talk to Iran. They were then expected to rise once again when Iran rejected the US preconditions. But OPEC looks set to agree no change to crude output. That's despite the attempts of Hugo Chavez to propose trading oil in euros instead of dollars and to cut production. Cutting production would make Venezuela more money per barrel, and talk of switching to euros ensures prices stay high as Western markets panic. But there's little evidence that any of the OPEC countries have any real enthusiasm for either idea. Keeping the petroleum price high makes some of Venezuela's oil suddenly viable. Once considered too expensive to extract because it's so heavy, thick and expensive to refine, it's now more worthwhile to exploit. Chavez will try to push OPEC to agree to set $50 a barrel as the new rock-bottom price. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
ExxonMobil shareholders vote for the seventh year in a row not to include lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender workers in the company's anti-discrimination policy. Rebecca Miles files this report.
The Human Rights Campaign, the U.S.'s largest lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender political organization, reports, however, record numbers of Exxon shareholders voted for the non-discrimination policy at a shareholders' meeting yesterday. This year, 34.6% of shareholders voted to add sexual orientation, an increase from 29.4% of shareholders who voted in 2005. Brad Luna from Human Rights Campaign said it's about time ExxonMobil joined the 85% of Fortune 500 companies who include sexual orientation in their policies to protect their workers. But he was encouraged by the continual growth of support among shareholders. Other major energy companies include the anti-discrimination policy, and so did Mobil Corporation before its merger with Exxon. Luna is encouraged there may be further changes ahead when Lee Raymond steps down as chairman later this year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
A federal judge has given the Bush administration just 3 weeks to indicate whether it was conducting surveillance of confidential attorney-client discussions between people who were detained immediately following the 9/11 attacks and their attorneys. The ruling orders former Attorney General John Ashcroft, FBI Director Robert Mueller, and other government attorneys to admit or deny whether they are aware of any monitoring or surveillance of communications. Michael Winger with Covington & Burling is one of the attorneys in the case.
We know that the government is intercepting communications from the U.S. to people abroad. Because our clients were arrested in the 9/11 investigation, even though they were cleared, it seemed possible that they could come within the unknown scope of this wiretapping program that's going on. So we wanted to know whether they are. We asked, and the government has so far resisted answering.
And that was attorney Michael Winger with Covington & Burling. And finally, tens of thousands of Honduran and Nicaraguan immigrants nationwide risk losing their legal status in the United States today if they have not renewed their temporary work permits under a program to help victims of natural disasters. It is feared that some mistakenly believe that they are on the path to becoming a citizen. Only half of the eligible applicants have yet to apply for renewal. They could lose their jobs and face deportation if they miss today's deadline. And those are some of the news headlines. I'm Mitch Jesrich for Free Speech Radio News.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mottaki has responded to a U.S. negotiations offer by stating that Iran will not give up what it calls its right to enrich uranium, but is ready to hold talks with the United States. Analysts say that despite this outcome, the very fact that some exchange happened presents a major breakthrough since the two countries had not talked for 27 years, ever since the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979. Anastasia Genetsditska reports from Washington, D.C.
U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said that President Bush wants to act as the leader of what he called an international front in negotiations with Iran and other states.
The United States is willing to exert strong leadership to give diplomacy its very best chance to succeed. Thus, to underscore our commitment to a diplomatic solution and to enhance the prospects for success, as soon as Iran fully and verifiably suspends its enrichment and reprocessing activities, the United States will come to the table with our EU colleagues and meet with Iran's representatives.
The statement by Rice was followed by a drop in the price of oil down $1.69 a barrel. Representative of the European Union on matters of foreign policy, Javier Solana, stated enthusiastically that this new development raises hopes of establishing relations with Iran that are based on mutual trust.
In the Middle East, in a region as complicated as that, the least we need now is more of potential nuclear weapons, if we need it less. And we need to see how this region gets stabilized. But we hope very much that the package will be an attractive package that will be interesting for the Iranians to think about it, to think about it seriously.
Pan-Arab daily Al-Quds Al-Arabi was also positive about the possibility of talks. It applauded Iran for getting the U.S. to abandon its, quote, previously arrogant position. It stated that, quote, this is a good lesson for certain Arab leaders if they want to deal with the U.S. in a different way and without being subdued followers. It turned out that positive reactions were premature. In today's statement made for Iranian TV, Iran's foreign minister Manoukher Mottaki was critical of the goals that U.S. pursues by offering Iran talks. He said that Rice's statement was not something new. This is what was said in her previous speeches and interviews. It lacked a logical and new solution to resolve Iran's nuclear issue. It was like a piece of literature and was aimed at covering up their failure in Iraq and other parts of the world. President Bush was quick to respond.
It's going to be up to the Iranians to make their decision. And if they choose not to verifiably suspend, we have laid the groundwork for an effective international response. If they choose not to suspend and verify, if they continue their obstinance, they continue to say to the world, we really don't care what your opinion is, then the world is going to act in concert.
According to Amira Woods, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, the U.S. offer was rejected by Iran because it was not expressed in constructive terms.
If the U.S. were sincere about a multilateralist route, then they would have already have begun talks with the other members of the international community. I think putting conditions on these talks now, it's a bit of a cause for concern. It is almost as if the U.S. is not really interested in having these direct talks to happen if they were to place so many conditions for their actually moving forward. I think the concern is that in the wake of Iraq, where the U.S. unilaterally went forward and launched an illegal war, that path may be pursued again under the guise of pressure from the Security Council for nuclear disarmament.
Both sides' propositions were loaded with language and conditions the other side was certain to find objectionable. Despite that, according to analysts, the very fact of reaching out may offer a small, if incremental, step towards political resolution. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditskaya in Washington, D.C.
The U.S. military ordered commanders to hold ethics trainings today in response to increasing outrage over reports that U.S. Marines killed 24 unarmed civilians in the western Iraqi town of Haditha last year. In explaining his decision, Lieutenant General Peter Chiarelli said 99.9% of the roughly 150,000 U.S.-led troops in Iraq are performing magnificently daily and that they do the right thing even when no one's watching. But many Iraqis say that massacres like the one in Haditha are all too common in U.S.-occupied Iraq. FSRN's Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib report.
Iraqis are outraged at reports of a massacre in Haditha, but they're hardly surprised. Almost everyone in Iraq has a similar story. Nezar al-Samarai is a lawyer from the western Iraqi city Samarra. In 2004, U.S. soldiers detained two of his nephews, ran their car over with a tank, and then threw them off a bridge to their deaths. Nezar argued the case in court, winning $2,500 in compensation for each dead nephew. One of the American soldiers was sentenced to 45 days in prison.
When we describe this kind of incident as normal because it has happened over and over in Iraq, not because it is normal or because the Iraqi people accept it, but because it has happened a lot and there's no reaction from the U.S. government to stop it. So people will say it's normal. I'm a lawyer, and I think that what they have done is a war crime, and if the Americans let the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague handle it, they will find thousands of its kind.
Indeed, Nezar al-Samarai has had his own run-ins with the U.S. military. In 2004, he was severely beaten by U.S. troops while driving his family to the hospital. On May 5th of this year, he says, he was tied up and beaten in his own home during a house-to-house raid by American forces. During the same raid, U.S. soldiers attacked a neighboring home for the disabled.
One of the houses that they raided was a house for disabled people, and the military killed three of them and injured another two. That was not because they did anything, of course. They were disabled. The other two are still in the hospital, and we do not know what will happen to them.
But at the White House, the increasing barrage of questions focuses only on the killing of 24 Iraqis, including women and children in Haditha, November 19, 2005. George Bush's spokesman, Tony Snow.
There are two tracks. Number one is what happened with the reporting of the incident and what happened. And the Marines are taking both of those very seriously and they're proceeding very aggressively.
No one asked Snow about a separate series of allegations by Iraq's ambassador to the United States, Samir Soumadeh, who is accusing the Marines of killing his cousin during a house-to-house raid in Haditha last June. The ambassador says the killing was completely unprovoked and that the Marines were smiling when they left his family's home. The Pentagon says they investigated the matter and there was no unlawful killing. It's difficult to independently verify such reports because most human rights groups have left the country, citing security concerns. Nada Doumani is spokesperson for the International Red Cross Iraq, which is now based in Amman, Jordan.
Since some time, we've been very much constrained and limited in our movements in Iraq. So we don't move everywhere in Iraq. Unfortunately, we're not present everywhere, and therefore we cannot comment on events that are happening in some in all areas in Iraq.
Still, the number of disturbing allegations is staggering. Nezar al-Samarai's cousin, Sheikh Ahmed Yahir al-Samarai, is an important tribal leader in western Iraq. It was his sons who were thrown off a bridge to their deaths in 2004.
What happened in Haditha was just one example. If the Americans make a real investigation and are honest, they'll find thousands like it. It's an everyday incident.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
Today marks the official start of the hurricane season, and the city of New Orleans doesn't have levees sufficient to support it if another major storm hits. Chief of the Army Corps of Engineers, Lieutenant General Carl Strock, said that a detailed analysis found that levees in Louisiana had design defects.
We must make it very clear that we stand behind our work. We do take accountability. And in this case, it's been sobering for us, but really this is the first time that the Corps of Engineers has had to stand up and say, we had a catastrophic failure of one of our projects.
Yet hundreds of people have moved back to New Orleans, and more say that they're coming back. FSRN's Christian Roseland files this report.
And we wonder, where is the outrage? Good.
Sandy Rosenthal stood in the summer heat on the banks of the 17th Street Canal this Monday, Memorial Day in New Orleans. She was there to commemorate Americans who died both in foreign wars and in Hurricane Katrina, but also to ask why the United States is not doing more to protect the citizens of New Orleans. Rosenthal is the director of levees.org, a group dedicated to holding the Army Corps of Engineers accountable for the levee failures in Hurricane Katrina.
This was a man-made disaster caused by deeply ingrained institutional problems at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the failure of Congress to adequately fund the Corps.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has spent more than $800 million repairing the levee system in New Orleans since last fall's storm. Colonel Louis Sutliff III is the commander of Task Force Guardian, the Army Corps of Engineers' plan to restore the levee system. Sutliff explains that the task of repairing the levees is enormous.
Of that 350 miles, well over half, about 169 miles of levees and flood walls were damaged. All the water control structures, 80-some percent of the pumping stations. Our strategy remains the same, which is fix this system to what it was pre-Katrina, because we can do it. We had the money to do it before 1 June to afford a level of protection back to New Orleans that really protected the city for decades.
However, the Corps is behind schedule on some aspects of the project, and the floodgates on two canals are still under construction. And ultimately, the end goal of Task Force Guardian is merely to restore the levees to the state they were before Hurricane Katrina. Many in New Orleans, like Rosenthal of levees.org, say that goal is not good enough.
And they're doing a great job of getting the levees back up to pre-Katrina. Pre-Katrina was unacceptable.
A report issued May 22nd by the Independent Levee Investigation Team says the levees surrounding the Crescent City were improperly designed, constructed, monitored, and maintained. But beyond this, the investigation team, led by UC Berkeley Professor Raymond Seed, says the entire institutional framework behind levee construction in Louisiana, including the Army Corps of Engineers, needs drastic change.
These problems, in turn, arose largely as a result of organizational, political, and resource allocation issues intrinsic to the process as it currently exists. I myself would not purchase property and move into New Orleans if the intent of the nation and the state is to continue to do business as usual. We need to change how we do this. We cannot simply change the engineering details. If we want to make a safe levee system, we have to overhaul the process that creates it.
Yet despite the lack of protection in the event of another major storm, people continue to move back to New Orleans. Henry Irving lives in the city's Lower Ninth Ward and lost his home in Hurricane Betsy in 1965 as well. He says that he is rebuilding, but he has his own evacuation plans if the neighborhood is flooded yet again. But you've been flooded twice. Are you rebuilding?
Yeah. I'm rebuilding because they don't want me to rebuild.
and I'm hard-headed. I'm 70 years old, and I ain't going nowhere. But I'm not even much concerned about it because I can't do nothing about it. If the hurricane come, all I can do is take my truck, pack up, and go. And I make my own hurricane plans. See, because I have extra gas tanks and all of that. So if the weather gets bad, then I'll go fill up all my gas cans, and I'll hit the road.
For Free Speech Radio News in New Orleans, this is Christian Roseland.
Brother Cornell West, I'm just hoping and praying that you have the good enough sense to always tune in to Free Speech Radio News. Lays bare the truth and inspires you to fight for justice.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has asked the U.S. to facilitate Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan, and the UN to agree to a joint manhunt for LRA rebel chief Joseph Kony, who's suspected to be hiding out in the Congolese Garamba National Park. Museveni says that while the Ugandan army had the capacity to repel any attacks, the obstacle was Lord's Resistance Army rebels roaming free in Congo. Emmanuel Lokela reports from Kampala, Uganda.
At a meeting with the United States diplomatic delegation this week, President Museveni called on the U.S. government to persuade an agreement among the DRC, Sudan, UN, and Uganda to hunt LRA leader Joseph Kony jointly. All four parties have still failed to reach agreement on how to tackle reported LRA presence in Congo. The Ugandan president went on to say that the U.S., which is heading global efforts against terrorism, should act quickly because ending the LRA terror is no longer solely a Ugandan problem, but needs the cooperation of countries Kony has fled to. The presidential spokesman, Hon. Peter Komoloit, says United States involvement is critical because of its stature on the U.N. Security Council.
The president has mentioned the United States specifically because it's one of the countries that the Security Council as permanent member. And since basically the mandate of disarming the LRA in that area of the Congo lies with the UN mission MONUC, I think the president has argued rightly that the best placed group to prevail on MONUC to do much more to disarm the LRA should be the permanent members of the Security Council. And the U.S. is the leading member in this group. It's the leading funder of the United Nations.
Mr. Museveni's call comes amid rising hostilities between Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo over alleged infiltration into Congolese territory by the Ugandan army, which is ostensibly tracking LRA fighters. But the elite unit of the Congolese army, FARDC, that was sent to disarm the LRA in Garamba National Park, has instead turned against the Ugandan army, UPDF, accusing it of illegally entering into its territory. Captain John Peter Malengo, commander of the special unit sent to deal with the LRA threat, has told reporters that their enemy is Uganda. In an interview with the New Vision, a Uganda daily newspaper, Malengo said they are gathering evidence of UPDF infiltration and handing it over to the UN. The Congolese office, according to the New Vision, said Uganda was using the LRA as a pretext to invade their country. In Captain Molengo's words, they just want to enter and loot our wealth like they did in the past. LRA is not in Congo. But Ugandan army representatives dismiss the claim and say they are treating the remarks as the personal opinion of the Congolese officer. Uganda army spokesman Major Felix Kulaije denies that his military made incursions into Congo and adds that Chief of Defense Forces General Ronda Nyakirima has just finished up successful discussions with his Congolese counterpart on a joint operation.
The captain found that the border post cannot represent state-to-state relations or military-to-military relations. The two countries are enjoying very cordial relations. The Chief of Defense Forces of Uganda was in DRC 6 days ago. He met his counterpart and held very fruitful discussions, during which they agreed on a number of joint mechanisms to deal with the rebels that are disturbing Eastern DRC, the issue of Kony phenomenon that is becoming a regional issue, since now Kony has moved into Central Africa areas, Congo is in Central Africa, having moved away from Sudan. So what the captain was expressing are personal views which the Ugandan military leadership is going to pursue with the military command of Congo.
The U.S. ambassador here, Stephen Browning, has promised to inform his government of President Museveni's request. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Lokela reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Portland Mayor Tom Potter has made public an attempt by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to make contact with a source inside the local city hall. The FBI acknowledged that one of their agents had approached a city employee, but said the agency is not currently investigating Portland city government. FSRN's Julie Sabatier has the story.
On May 11th, an employee of the city attorney's office for Portland, Oregon, was approached by Agent Jeffrey Pritchett of the FBI. Agent Pritchett, who was loosely acquainted with the city employee, asked if she knew any city council members. He mentioned that white-collar crime and public corruption are top priorities for the FBI and asked if she would be willing to pass on information about people who work for the city of Portland.
I was shocked.
That's Portland Mayor and former Chief of Police Tom Potter. He became aware of the incident after the unnamed city employee reported it to her boss. When he met with Special Agent Dan Nielsen of the FBI, he learned that the Bureau does not currently have an investigation open at City Hall.
There should be some mutual respect and understanding of what each other's roles are. And for me, that's not the job of the FBI to spy on local governments when they have no knowledge of any wrongdoing.
Agent Nielsen, who serves as Assistant Special Agent in charge of the Portland Division of the FBI, says Mayor Potter overreacted to the conversation that took place between his agent and the city employee.
I tried to talk to the mayor. It didn't seem like he really wanted to hear much beyond, gee, was the FBI spying on me? That was simply not the case. It wasn't the context, it wasn't the nature, it wasn't the intent.
Portland city government has had a rocky relationship with the FBI during Mayor Potter's term in office. Last spring, with overwhelming public support, the city council voted to pull Portland police officers off the FBI-led Joint Terrorism Task Force. And Portlanders haven't forgotten that one of their own citizens, lawyer Brandon Mayfield, was wrongfully arrested in connection with the 2004 Madrid train bombings. Again, Mayor Potter.
Public corruption exists in the United States. There's just no doubt about that. And that there has to be someone who investigates that. And that's probably a good role for the FBI. But when you have no knowledge and that you are not conducting any investigation into any wrongdoing on the part of a city, what is the role of the FBI then?
This comes at a time when the role of federal investigators is very much at the forefront of the national discussion. An FBI raid on Congressman William Jefferson's office was heavily criticized Tuesday during hearings before the House Judiciary Committee. And Americans are still reeling from the revelation that all of our phone records are available to the National Security Agency. Oregon ACLU Executive Director David Fidanke says the incident in Portland is part of a national trend towards more aggressive FBI tactics when it comes to investigating political groups and government employees without any evidence of criminal activity.
The Attorney General's guidelines, which were originally put in place during President Ford's administration in the mid-70s, those guidelines originally were designed to prevent this kind of phishing expedition by the FBI. Unfortunately, former Attorney General Ashcroft greatly weakened those guidelines and opened the door for these kinds of abuses on a broad scale.
At Mayor Potter's request, the FBI will conduct an internal investigation to determine whether or not Agent Pritchett acted appropriately. Agent Nielsen says he welcomes the evaluation, but he maintains that there has been no violation of policy here. For FSRN, this is Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Today's headlines editor is Mitch Jezerich, sitting in for Shannon Young. And today's Washington editor is Anastasia Genetstitska, sitting in for Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can find archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary online at fsrn.org. You can also email us your questions, comments, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Maura Bogado.